Welcome to Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers Unplugged, where we'll be talking true crime and news of the day with other authors, celebrities, and difference makers. Now, today's guest, New York Times best-selling author Casey Sepp, author of Furious Hours. Casey, welcome to the show with Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge. How you doing?
Just fine. Thanks so much for having me.
Hi, Casey. Nice to have you.
Full disclosure, Casey, the way I found your book, this is pre-COVID, so I'm walking through my neighborhood Barnes & Noble, and a couple of things jump right out at me. First was the name Casey. I always zero in on other Caseys, so I thought, oh, okay, I got to check this book out. And then I see the title, which is Furious Hours. Now, I have a book and movie called The Finest Hours. So, again, that drew me to the subject matter. And then I see the name Harper Lee as well. And I thought, okay, I'm in. I didn't even need to, you know, look at the photos in the book. I didn't need to read anything more. I just picked it up, bought it, and I devoured it within, you know, I would say 24 hours. And I love the tagline, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. Now, this is a book that has been lauded by everybody in the country, including President Obama. Congratulations on that. Tell us a little bit about how you found this just insane story.
Yeah, well, thanks so much. That's such a generous intro. And, you know, I feel like when we're done, I'll have to write to my publisher to be like, good job on the subtitle. It really works.
Yeah.
You know, this is what you want to hear. And, you know, I think for readers of true crime, you want to give them a sense of what they're in for. So it felt really important to kind of foreground this case. And, you know, I found my way to it kind of the way you found your way to the book, which is the moment you were Harper Lee and a serial killing preacher, it's just, you got to know more.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was a sensational case in Alabama when it happened. It was a series of murders between 1970 and 1977. And then Harper Lee, so we're talking, you know, 17 years after To Kill a Mockingbird, she hears about this preacher who's been accused of killing two wives, a nephew, a brother, and a stepdaughter. And she goes to the town to look into it. And she arrives in time, not for one of his trials, but actually for the trial of the vigilante who murdered him. So at the funeral of his last victim, he was gunned down. And that's when Harper Lee found out about this story. So I was drawn to the case by her interests. And of course, you know, for folks who don't know her career, she was a childhood friend of Truman Capote's. They stayed close as adults. So she actually had a hand in helping to report In Cold Blood. So, you know, she's one of us. She's a true crime writer. She followed cases like this. She loved courtrooms. She loved trials. So it was really fun to bring that all together and marry it to the original story that she tried to tell about the Reverend himself.
Now, how did you find out about the story initially?
Yeah, so I was reporting on Harper Lee. I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker, mm-hmm. and I was writing about Harper Lee in 2015 because, you know, after decades and decades of saying she was never going to publish a book, kind of unexpectedly, there was this announcement that she would be publishing a second novel. And, you know, she was in her 80s. There were a lot of questions about whether she actually written the book, whether she consented to publication, you know, who was managing her affairs, who stood to gain financially. So, you know, I went down to report on what I thought might be one kind of crime story. You know, people were using words like elder abuse and exploitation. And, you know, I thought that's what I was going to write about. And I wrote a short story about that, but I got much more interested in the Maxwell case and this nonfiction book that Harper Lee had tried to write in the 70s and 80s.
First of all, I mean, holy shit about Willie Maxwell. You know, I mean, you really draw his character out in a way that, you know, just kept me reading consistently throughout the entire book. It seemed like every page he was doing something to, you know, obviously manipulate the people around him. And he had such a, I would say, a long leash, you know, from authorities to manipulate these folks. Everybody knew the danger that Willie Maxwell posed to his family. And I think didn't he prey on that a little bit, or preyed on, you know, the idea that voodoo was something that this mystical quality in the Deep South that people, you know, had to really take seriously.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there's kind of a straightforward question for crime reporters who covered the story at the time and now decades later, kind of trying to sort out what happened. And you're right to point out, you know, the long leash that a minister had. So this guy was a Baptist preacher. You know, he presided over funerals, presided over weddings, preached, you know, at churches in the area, you know, every single Sunday. And so when he was accused of murdering his wife, right away, a lot of people came to his defense. And, you know, the credulity of how could a man of the cloth have done this? He's obviously been framed. He's a grieving widower. You know, there was a lot of credit given to him and permissiveness that went on and on and on. And, you know, on that first wife, he had a couple of insurance policies, but those weren't quite as public as all the policies he had on the second wife, who died under almost identical circumstances. And so between 1970 and 1972, you know, affairs came out, insurance fraud came out. And I think people who had been inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt stopped and then tried to figure out how he was getting away with it. And, you know, again, add to that a brother, a nephew, a stepdaughter, when he was never convicted of any of these murders and the insurance policies just grew and grew and grew, people started to talk about how someone could get away with this. And again, we're talking about a Black minister in the Deep South in the 1970s. You know, he did go to trial. He was investigated. You know, the State Bureau of Investigation got involved. So there were, you know, there was a lot of law enforcement attention, and yet this guy did not go to prison. And that's when the voodoo rumors started. So even though he was a Baptist minister, one of the most prominent explanations for how he could get away with this, you know, he was winning all of these civil trials to collect on the insurance policies. He was never going to jail. And so what people decided was that he was a voodoo priest and that his powers, you know, his dark magic, his spiritual powers, which again, you know, this is not an uncommon set of beliefs in the rural South, equivalent to all sorts of spiritualities you find around the world. But, you know, there was this sense that how else could he be getting away with this? And that's the story and the rumor and innuendo that grew up. And you're right, it was a lot of fun to try to sort fact from fiction, just make sure the book captured right. That kind of, you know, fear and, in, you know, just the environment of what it was like at the time, which was palpable fear, you know, not just for his relatives, but for anyone who, you know, might have been solicited as an accomplice or accused or anyone who stood in his way. I think that's when it becomes this kind of claustrophobic story where the fear just spreads wherever Willie Maxwell goes. You know, you can't look him in the eye. He'll turn himself into a black cat. You know, he can move from here to there with, you know, magic authority. And that sort of stuff, I think, is what gives the book a lot of character and what drew Harper Lee to the story, because there's just so much going on, not just the actual crimes and the financial fraud, but just the way the community reacted.
I think the way the community reacted, the way, you know, where the bodies of the victims were found, which were, you know, very close to where the minister was living at the time, all the suspicions seemed to be focused directly on him. But he had, to your point, this power over the community. And I was shocked that so many women were seduced, you know, mentally and physically by this guy, and knowing full well that they could be his next victim.
Yeah, I mean, that's its own interesting part of the story. So I mentioned two of his wives turned up dead, and only one of those deaths was declared a homicide. The other was declared an accidental death. And, you know, when I say the circumstances were similar, all of these murders were staged as car accidents. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just as you say, you know, his vehicle is found on the side of the road, not far from where he lived in the middle of the night. You know, the patterns were there. And I think that's what made it so frustrating for law enforcement. And you know, again, one wife is one thing, but a second wife under identical circumstances. Right. People were truly shocked that actually he took a third wife. And so his last victim was a stepdaughter, and she was actually related to his third wife. And so, you know, over and over again, the first Mrs. Maxwell, the second Mrs. Maxwell, the third Mrs. Maxwell, that is part of what just made the story incredible for people who were following along, you know, who would marry him and why. And, you know, actually, even with the second wife, he was never charged with the crime, because again, it was never declared a homicide, but actually he was only able to marry his second wife, who was supposed to testify against him in the first murder trial. So he flips a state witness, they get married, and supposedly he was only able to marry her because he had actually murdered her husband. You know, to talk about the rumors, yeah, you know, people just, any murder in the Tri-County area, you know, might well have been the Reverend Maxwell. You know, it was just where you consolidated your fear.
So talk a little bit about your investigative techniques. Obviously, you went down to the community. You were very absorbed with the environment itself.
Yeah, so this all took place, for folks who know Alabama well, this all took place along the outskirts of Lake Martin. So we're talking about Coosa County and Tallapoosa County, and a lot of the trials were in the Rockford Courthouse or in Alexander City is kind of the big town there, big mill town. And, you know, it's a beautiful part of the country. And it was a part of the country I didn't know well before finding out about this story. And I did some reporting down in Monroeville, which is where Harper Lee was born and raised, and in New York City, where she lived most of her adult life. But in terms of where the crime story took place, it was a lot of fun to just go and stay. And yeah. I think, you know, for people who do true crime writing, you can write these stories from the police reports and from, you know, the courthouse documents. And that's one version. And, you know, the facts are there and you get the names and you get the vital statistics from the death certificates and the autopsies. But it's another thing to go and, you know, talk to people who knew the victims or who lived through this or, you know, the original reporters who covered the story. And I think for me, that's what made the book so much fun, was really just getting to know this part of Alabama and getting to hear so many different perspectives. Because, you know, for a lot of people who lived through this, this was just, you know, a carnival show. It was a curiosity. They'd open the newspaper, they'd read about it, or they'd make jokes about it. But, you know, if you were actually living in one of these small Black villages where the Reverend had been your Sunday minister, you know, this was a totally different story. Or the second wife that he's accused of killing, you know, had two children when they got married. So obviously for her survivors or for distant relatives of the Reverend, this is a totally different experience. And I think those are the kinds of distinctions and differences you draw out when you can actually spend time thinking about these cases and interviewing people who have a lot of different, you know, this wasn't the 17th century, it was the 1970s, but even that, getting to go and getting, you know, a tour from who, you know, was born in the 20s, who could take you around and say, that's where this mill used to be. And, you know, we used to meet the train here and these are how the whistle sounded. Or, you know, let me tell you about how pulpwooding worked at the time. Yeah. You know, these regional specialties, I think that's what's really fun about reporting. And then you can bring all that atmosphere and energy into a book so that it's not just the documents and the bare facts.
Hey, Casey, like our fans who tune in here on Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers, we're all about truth. Working on our projects, I need a boost sometimes. I love my coffee, but I'm really loving these true lifestyle drinks.
Me too, Dave. There are 6 different flavors for every activity. They're gluten and GMO-free, organic, vegan, and there's no artificial sweeteners or additives. They're clean, and they contain all sorts of vitamins and nutrients, and they're damn tasty.
You know, True's founder, Jack McNamara, is a former pro hockey player, and he created True because he was looking for healthy energy drinks that wouldn't make you crash. I've been loving Energy, the Orange Mango Wake Up Blend, as well as Focus, the Apple Kiwi Brain Blend. Jack and his team have scientifically engineered some game-changing beverages, and I'm working several of them into my daily routine.
And I'm making them part of my lifestyle, too. True drinks for true crime fans. Go to drinktrue.com and use the code SAINTS to get 30% off your purchase. Now, back to Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers.
No, Casey, it's Dave Wedge here, and it's so refreshing to hear you talk like that, because that's exactly how Casey and I work. Too many reporters, in my opinion, these days don't get out of the office. I worked at the Boston Herald for 14 years, and the editors there used to say they call them phone jockeys. You know, they just call people and get the story. And it's like, I was always leaving the office and they were like, where the hell are you going? I'm like, to get a story, you know? So, it's so awesome to hear that's, you know, your passion as well, because that is where you get the stories, you know, those old school gum shoeing, as we kind of call it. And, you know, Casey and I just wrote a book with James Patterson about the John Lennon murder. And we basically did what you did in Alabama in New York. And we went and reinvestigated that case, tracked down every witness to John Lennon's murder. We pulled out the old case files that no one had looked at in decades, interviewed the doctors that treated John Lennon. So, and that's why, you know, people are like, how do you write that story? It's like, well, we went back and looked at it and found new things and new nuances. And that's really what makes these stories come to life. So I applaud you for that. But given all that I just said, I feel like there's a movie in this. Do you have any, you must have some film interest in this book.
Well, I love that. I mean, I would love it if someone made a movie, but it's also, you know, a lot of times people ask, Harper Lee was trying to write her own book about this case. And I think one of the kind of most frustrating things that happened for her is everybody who she interviewed at the time not only thought it should be a movie, but that she should pay for their life rights.
That's right.
That they should be involved in the casting decisions. And so, I mean, I think it's just one of these interesting cases where, truth be told, you go and you read the original court transcripts and people were talking about it like it was a movie at the time. Mm. You know, it was so unbelievable. It was so sensational. So the language they had for it was, you know, when people watch the Reverend get gunned down in the funeral home, you know, quote, it was like a movie. I couldn't believe it. You know, the tape was rolling. You know, it was so dramatic. They didn't say it was like a dream. They said it was like a movie.
Like a movie.
TV show. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, from your lips to God's ears, you know, I'm sure you guys have a big audience. If you've got a producer listening, tell them to get involved and, you know, take it to the
screen. This is a perfect limited. I mean, it really is. You've got, you know, characters that jump off the page, not only in, you know, in the criminal case, but really taking a look at the friendship between Nell and Truman Capote. And, you know, and oftentimes the betrayal that Truman, you know, I would say brought into that relationship with her. I mean, he really leaned on Harper Lee quite a bit. And I think a lot of that might have been obviously their childhood friendship coming to bear. But I think, you know, he understood, he was a bit of an opportunist and understood that, you know, Harper's perspective made him a better writer.
Yeah, I think that's really perceptive. And look, I mean, Dave, in case you guys are collaborators, you work with other writers, I'm always interested in how artists work and, you know, how creativity is solitary or collaborative. And so I think, you know, thanks for noticing that. It's part of the crime story that is really interesting to me. And I think there was jealousy and there was rivalry, but there was also love and support. And, you know, to look at any friendship across the decades, these are people who met, you know, when they were under 10 years old and right. all the way through their lives were in touch and following each other's work. And, you know, sure. I mean, was Capote petty? Of course he was. It's been said over and over again that, you know, the worst thing she ever did was win a Pulitzer when he didn't win one.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, was really capable of holding a grudge and being envious. But on the other hand, you know, how improbable these two great American writers grew up literally right next door to each other.
We always talk about that, you know, I mean, it, you know, with our Lennon book, it was like, how improbable, you know, was it when John Lennon met Paul McCartney? Very similar to, you know, Truman and Nell, quite frankly. You've got these two outcasts in a very rural community that find each other and become, you know, worldwide celebrities, and, you know, their work is going to outlast them for decades, if not hundreds of years.
Yeah, I think that's true. And obviously at the heart of a lot of the stories we tell are these, you know, dark murders and betrayals and fraud stories. There's always around the edge these very, very human dramas, and it's friendship, it's marriages, it's, you know, parents and children. And I think the layered a book can become, it's what's great about a book compared to an article, you can really follow those tangents. And, you know, you can take a minute to go to Kansas with Capote and Lee and think about what their reporting there was like. And you can follow Harper Lee into her childhood. You know, her sister and her father were lawyers, so she grew up in this courthouse and, you know, was reading Sherlock Holmes and thinking about how crime worked. And, you know, just to be patient with how complicated life is. It's not only murder, it's not only insurance fraud. There's all this other kind of beautiful textured life happening around the edges. So it's just another thing I enjoyed about the book. And it sounds like, you know, with your work, you really think through the human aspects of these stories.
You hit it right in the head. I mean, that's exactly what Casey and I talk about all the time, because we've written about a lot of tragedy and a lot of true crime. The episodes we do, they obviously have a very tragic element, a very shocking element. But at the heart of it, there's always humanity. And that's really what makes these books great and what makes true crime great. You know, for example, we did a book about the Boston Marathon bombings, not much more tragic than an 8-year-old boy dying at the hands of a terrorist, but we chose to tell that story through the eyes of the heroes and the people that survived and really bring the human element to it. And it, you know, I think about your book here, you've got a serial killer ripping people off and marrying people and killing them and staging murders, and yet somehow you brought a beautiful humanity to it that caught the attention of President Obama. What must have that been like for you to have him hailing your book?
Yeah, I mean, I'm worried it's going to sound like to your listeners I'm feeding you questions. Like, is there anything I'd rather talk about than how much President Obama liked the book? Yeah, that was really a fun surprise. I mean, I think...
I would say so.
Yeah, but I think, you know, it's a great example. Harper Lee is just such an important author, you know, and in the literary history of this country, I think probably President Obama is like a lot of us. He's just interested in her life and wanted to learn more. You know, she virtually disappeared from the public eye. So there was always this curiosity about what she was reading, what she was trying to write, you know, what her afterlife was like. And I just think, you know, not in a million years, if you had said to me, what do you think Harper Lee is up to? Would I have guessed she was trying to write true crime? I just didn't know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, not that Mockingbird doesn't have, you know, murder and a courtroom drama, but I just think it's really interesting that that's where she went as a writer, that she was interested in nonfiction, mm-hmm. that true crime captured her attention, that she felt like these kinds of courtroom dramas were the way to talk about race and diversity and difference. So I think probably, you know, he's just like one of us. He's interested in her life. Mm. And that's what drew him to the book.
And I think what you did so well in the book is really draw out the frustration of being a writer. You know, here Harper Lee is thinking, okay, this is my, you know, my long awaited follow-up to Mockingbird. And she struggles with the material because it's not tying together the way that she wanted it to.
Yeah. Or just, you know, look, you guys are crime reporters. It's really hard to figure out what happened. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, the police fail to get a conviction. And it's not that there aren't, you know, very straightforward theories about who did it and how they did it. But there's a, you know, country mile between that and proving it. And I think for Harper Lee, some of the frustration was this was supposed to be an open and shut case. And actually, it was really hard to document mm-hmm. things. It was really hard to get people on the record. You know, people told self-serving stories or they were afraid to talk. And, you know, she confronted the challenges that a lot of people do, which is sometimes really great stories are hard to actually pin down on the page. And, you know, the suspicions people have are not the same as what you can prove. And she was writing at a time when a lot of these characters were alive. So at one point she was really concerned about being sued.
Yep.
You know, she was very, which again, I think we all-
Always concerned about her taxes.
Concerned about her taxes too. I mean, right, a whole other story. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, some of the drama of the book, as crazy as it sounds, is writer's block.
Yeah.
And, you know, what happened to this incredible writer? And I think for people who do, you know, write books or just think about writing, that's kind of reassuring. You realize even someone as successful as Harper Lee struggled. You know, mm-hmm. it's not always easy. It's not always straightforward. And there is hard work involved. You know, even a great story, you know, even literally the best story, it's a page turner, it should be a movie. You still have to get it down on paper.
That's
you
right.
Know,
absolutely.
Actually write it. That's the hard part.
So Casey, in doing some research on you before this interview, I read several of your New Yorker articles and fabulous stuff, really. Every article you do is very interesting. But one caught my eye, speaking of books and authors, is the one you wrote about the Raven, the Lawrence, Kansas bookstore.
Oh, yes.
That's kind of struggling, and the guy, the owner, is battling, really, Amazon, kind of went after Amazon and said, look, you're killing independent bookstores. Talk to us a little bit about how important it is for the public to realize the difference between buying a book on Amazon and going to your local bookstore.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Thanks for asking it. And I do get to write about a lot of different things. And, you know, I think in the last probably month, I've written about like the New Testament, Danny Kane with this bookstore out in Kansas. Mm-hmm. And I think I wrote a book about one of the first wrote a review of a book about one of the first female doctors in this country. So, you know, it's a lot of different things that come together, but yeah, that's a bookstore out in Kansas. And I think, you know, it's a Main Street small town bookstore and
named after a book by Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, it started out as a mystery bookstore. Yeah, exactly. So that's why it's called The Raven. And, you know, they do a lot of author events, and I don't want to judge anybody's decisions. You know, life is complicated. You know, people shop where they shop. But I think what Danny would say is it's really important to realize if you spend all your money at Amazon, you're not going to have Main Street retailers. And, you know, whether that's your hardware store or, you know, your electronics store, or in his case, your bookstore, you know, there's not going to be anybody doing events. There's not going to be anybody when you need to get that last minute Mother's Day gift, or, you know, when you just don't know what to get for your sister because she's hard to shop for. And so, yeah, he's written a book about Amazon and kind of big box stores and how they work. And what I liked about Danny and why it was so great to write about him is he's not kind of anti anybody, but he's really pro small business. Mm-hmm, and, yeah. You know, I think he would say that, you know, when you buy a book from him, it means he can donate a book to the local middle school, and he can host an event for an up and coming author, and he can have a mystery book club, and, you know, that you just build a community around brick and mortar stores.
Yeah,
no.
it's a hard balance in America right now, because people want to save money and they want convenience. But we also need culture, and we need to preserve culture in the arts. And it's a delicate tightrope that America is walking right now. And I think that story really hit on it. So that was a great read.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we have a similar story here in the Boston area. Didn't have a happy ending. It's there was a mystery bookshop called Kate's mystery books in Cambridge. It's where I got my start. Dave, I'm sure you know, shopped there or spoke there, you know, when it was up and running. But this is where Dennis Lehane got his start. This is where George Higgins got his start. This is where Robert Parker, you know, used to show up, you know, biweekly just to browse the collection and talk to people that were, you know, shopping in that particular old Victorian home. I can just picture it right now. Mm. It was such a great place. And when that went out of business, I would say probably 5 years ago, it was just a death knell to the, you know, not only the readers, but the writing community as well. Because, you know, you need a place to gather and congregate. You need that, you know, Shakespeare and Company, if you will, that one place for writers to, you know, sit down with a cup of coffee or, you know, an adult beverage and just talk about their work.
Yeah. I mean, look, podcasts are great, but right, you know, after coronavirus, the idea that we could sit down, the three of us, and, you know, get out a copy of The Raven or talk about Edgar Allan Poe over beers, like, I just think that is culture and that is fun and it goes in unexpected ways. And, you know, it just enriches our lives, whether you're a writer or a reader or just somebody who wants to, you know, you grew up in Boston during the Whitey Bulger case, so you go to a book talk because you want to learn more about it. And, you know, I think that's what Danny would say, that you can call it a bookstore or you can call it a community hub or a community center, but there's something magical happening. And it's like this conversation, you know, you meet new people, you share new ideas, and that kind of stuff, you know, it's not impossible to do on the internet, but it's easier done in person.
Yeah.
And you know, you just get a more eclectic mix of folks and, you know, you have a reason to come together. So I think that was a fun piece. And just like you say, that's a bookstore in Lawrence, Kansas, but there's a bookstore like that everywhere. You know, there's one in Porter Square, there's one in Harvard Square, you know, there's Trident Books. Like,
yeah, right, right.
You go anywhere in Boston, you go anywhere, you know, I'm from Maryland and, you know, we've got a little independent bookstore in the town where I went to high school, or you drive to the Western Shore and, you know, there's Politics and Prose in D.C. So, you know, wherever you are, I think he would just say, give it a try, you know, and make some time in your life and maybe pay a couple bucks more for the book. But part of what you're buying is, you know, that support for authors and creativity and the arts in this country. So thanks so much for asking about that one.
And there was another piece you and your wife, Catherine, wrote about your reading during the pandemic. And she's got a new book coming out as well. It's a memoir, and I think you're in it, right? So can you talk a little bit about, I know you don't want to talk about her work probably, but if you could tell us a little bit about that.
I'd be happy to. I mean, for one thing, it's like you really get your comeuppance in life. People ask me all these questions about Harper Lee, and I talk about her private life, and I quote her letters, and you know, I'm kind of getting what I deserve, which is my wife went and wrote a book about our private life and, you know, how we work together as writers. And a lot of that book is about losing her father. So it's a story about grief and family and when you lose one, how you make one. So I'm really proud of her and I think it'll be fun. And truth be told, you know, I had a blast going around doing book events at bookstores around the country. And we're really hoping her book comes out in January. It's called Lost and Found. And we're really hoping to get back out on the road. And this interview started with, how did I find out about the Maxwell case? And, you know, I found out because I was down in Alabama talking to people.
Right.
And I feel like one of the things I most miss is like the happenstance of someone says, oh, you write about true crime. Did you ever hear about this case? Yeah, or, you know, oh, you write about books. You know, my father was a book publisher. And in the, you know, 1960s, he put out this book that nobody's heard of. You just get stories and you meet people. Absolutely. And you hear their stories. And I think as a writer, that's really the kind of, that's my gasoline. That's what fuels me. So I'm excited to get back on the road and be out in the world again.
Well, that's where the best ideas come from. Are you thinking about a follow-up? Right now, have you started putting pen to paper or typing? What's next for Casey Sepp?
Yeah, that's a fun question. I do have the idea for book two, and I've really just started to work on it in earnest, so it'll probably take me a little while, but I think it'll be fun. It's got an older story, so it's a shipwreck from the 17th century, but it's got a lot of kind of legal follow-up in the 20th century, so a lot about salvage law and how the, you know, how the laws affect salvage work and treasure hunters and who keeps what and what governments get. And so there's a lot of a contemporary piece to it. And
you're talking Casey's language right now.
There you go.
Well, one of the things that we're involved with here in Massachusetts is a pirate wreck called the Whydah, which is this is a ship that went down in 1717 off the coast of Cape Cod. And Dave and I have been working with the underwater explorer Barry Clifford since 1984 when he found the vessel. They've pulled up over $100 million worth of gold and silver from this shipwreck. But they continuously battle, you know, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts with regard to maritime law and really who, you know, who this bounty belongs to. So it's been an interesting journey, you know, working with these guys.
Yeah, you've been living it. I mean, you've been living it, and I'm trying to reconstruct one of these. And I just think it's awfully interesting. And, you know, the ways that our intuitions butt against, you know, the laws and the way that legal scholarship changes and different rights and claims are, you know, valid in one decade and maybe not the other. So, yeah, I think that stuff is all really interesting. Now, on the other hand, I'm really glad to not be sitting on $100 million of treasure I'm trying to, you know, keep from the government.
Yeah, right.
I found the book a year ago, you know, just as the pandemic was hitting. So I couldn't travel for a year. Nobody could travel, but I did travel in furious hours. So it was, you took me on a journey, you know, both mentally and almost physically, I think. And I just want to thank you for that and tell all of our listeners, you know, pick up this book. If you haven't read Furious Hours yet, pick it up. You'll be incredibly entertained and informed. And if you, you know, if you're a fan of books like, you know, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, and even some of, you know, Grisham's earlier novels, your book just is at the top of that heap.
Yeah, so that's so sweet. And I'll just say the thing I sometimes do, which is, I know it's an unlikely kind of tourism recommendation, and people are often telling you to go to Mexico or Bermuda or something, but I actually can't recommend Alabama enough. You know, a lot of people were really kind when I was working on this book, but it's also just got some of the prettiest rural countryside in the United States, and I had a great time there. And I think, you know, we all carry biases and stereotypes about certain people and certain places, but I think it's a really beautiful part of the country. And if people are looking for a road trip on the other side of COVID, you know, go and see where it all happened. Come back through Savannah, you know, stop at John Barrett's story on the way. Yeah, there's just a lot of the country to see and a lot of different lives to get to know. So thanks so much, and really just a lot of fun to get to talk about it with you.
Casey Sepp, thank you so much for joining Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers Unplugged. We can't wait to see what's next for you, and we hope to have you back on when your next one comes out.
Thanks so much.
All right, thanks, Casey.